Welcome to Breaking Free Podcast, your recovery, your way. I'm Tiffany.
And I'm Liv. You're in the right place if you want to explore what it means to be in recovery, to challenge the things that keep us small, and to learn how to thrive independently.
Together we are breaking free. Just a quick reminder that while I'm a nurse and a coach, and Liv is a coach, recovery advocate, and a writer, we are not doctors. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you need to, please, please see a doctor.
The Alana Club of Portland is proud to sponsor the Breaking Free podcast. Your recovery, your way, is at the heart of our approach to recovery support services.
Unity Recovery, an inclusive recovery community organization serving all of Philadelphia, is proud to support the Breaking Free podcast. Recovery is possible. Find your path to break free.
Welcome, everyone. This is episode 17. Today, we're going to talk about intuitive eating, and we're going to dive a little bit deeper into the barriers around that. Tiffany, why don't you share with me your experience?
So my experience with intuitive eating. Well, you know, from some of the other episodes, I've talked a little bit about this, but I have had disordered eating since I was about 10 years old and really started dieting from a young age, had body image issues from a young age. I don't think I've shared this. I did when I was 10, I fell off a horse and punctured my spleen, and I ended up in the hospital and I wasn't allowed to eat because they were worried that they may have to do surgery at any moment. And yeah, fortunately, I didn't end up having to have surgery. I still have my spleen, but I couldn't eat all week. And so I think that actually really started me off because then I got this kind of food scarcity mindset. And, you know, I already had some, you know, some wiring that wasn't great. But that really was an interesting experience because then I wanted to eat everything in sight. You know, my appetite, my body thought that I was in famine mode and I really needed to get some food in me. And I'm sure I gained weight because in addition to not being able to eat that week, when I went back to school, I wasn't allowed to run for 6 months or do any rough play because they were worried that my spleen would rupture. Wow. Yeah. And so I'm sure at that point I put on a lot of weight, which, you know, if I already had some like wondering about my body stuff coming up, then, you know, at that time, at that age, it was a hard time to have that experience. So I've always, you know, from a young age had issues. And for me, it was about losing weight. I weight cycled between my weight fluctuated. I don't know, the spread was 80, 90 or 100 pounds, something like that. And, you know, I'd go up and down and up and down and up and down. And then as I got older, I started trying to eat more for health. But again, it was really extreme. So I've done Whole30 four times. You know, yeah, I've done, you know, diets for
a whole lot of fun.
Yeah. It was, I mean, you know, I enjoyed some of the food, but it was so restrictive and definitely had the pendulum swing of like wanting to eat everything when I came off of it. And so, you know, and then I started doing diets for gut health issues and I have an autoimmune condition and they got really restrictive. And basically I, you know, just had a lot of shame around it and it was all or nothing. Someone said to me one time, I'm either doing Whole30 or the whole opposite. And I was like, yep. So we're eating perfectly or we're eating everything. Yeah. And that was how it was for me. So my disordered eating got bad enough that I sought therapy. Yeah. And fortunately, the therapist was trained in intuitive eating. And I immediately knew that this is what I needed in my life. So I dived in and I, you know, I learned everything I could about it and I was already a coach, fortunately. So, you know, I could bring myself through the process pretty well. And what happened for me is that, yes, it was challenging. But I was able to really see the value in accepting my body the way it is and having respect for myself and rejecting diet culture and really started to get focused on body attunement. So getting in tune with my body and connected again to my body, which was kind of still a new concept for me. You know, I've been in recovery for 20 plus years and I have been doing personal growth and development work, like hard, you know, intense, like deep work. And I've gone to therapy before, you know, I've even seen nutritionists, like I've done, and I've seen many different doctors, naturopaths, you know, and I actually myself am in, you know, I'm a nurse and I've been trained holistically as an integrative nurse coach. And I hadn't heard of it until, like, I hadn't even been introduced to the concept of intuitive eating. And I don't think any of these areas really encouraged me to be more in tune with my body, which is mind-blowing to me now.
Yeah.
Because it's so important.
Yeah, and you associate health with those professions, right?
Yeah.
And this seems like the most healthy approach to life.
Yeah. Hmm. I would say the only two things that I really experienced that did encourage body attunement was yoga, which I've done some yoga and I really appreciate yoga, but I have a back injury. So there was a lot of times that I couldn't really do it. Mm-hmm. And then I have a wonderful acupuncturist who in her own ways definitely encouraged me to be more connected to my body. Mm-hmm. And acupuncture itself has helped me to be more connected. But yeah, all these other things that I did and tried, and none of them really led me. I mean, ultimately, my path led me to discovering intuitive eating, but none of them had a direct, like, this would be something that would be really helpful for you. So now it has made my life so different, and I have freedom and balance, and I feel that I've healed my relationship with food. It doesn't mean I eat intuitively perfectly, but I have.
I think that's a really important point, right?
Yeah.
There is no perfect.
No.
Not with intuitive eating and not with recovery.
Yeah. So, I mean, this week I ate like tortilla chips and cheese like 3 times. Mm. And by the morning after the third time. Yeah. It was tasty. And, you know, part of it was just because I was busy. Part of it is because, my appetite had increased, whatever. Doesn't matter why. Mm-hmm. The point is by the third morning I woke up and like my joints hurt. I was like, all right, that's my body, right?
Yeah.
So I don't eat perfectly. I don't. And, you know, with intuitive eating, I know that food doesn't make me feel great. And usually I can do it like once and it's fine because there's a cumulative effect for me. The point is that I still am able to say that I've healed my relationship with food because I don't have shame and judgment about that. And when I woke up and my joints hurt, I was like, oh, I don't want to eat that today. My body hurts. So I had some kale. Anyway, so now, you know, I have healed my relationship with food and I feel so empowered. And there's so many things, you know, that this about me, that intuitive eating actually led me to decide to leave 12-step recovery because I didn't want to be exposed to any shaming language anymore. I didn't want to have anyone tell me that I was broken and that, you know, I'd never heal or recover. And
that you have to have a prescribed recovery that you need to attend so many meetings
a
week or whatever.
Yeah. So intuitive eating also showed me that it's, you know, I can have autonomy and a sense of agency and decide for myself what works for me. Mm. So it has empowered me in ways that I never even, you know, that aren't even related to food that I never even realized I needed or wanted in my life. And so that's why I do this work now, because I'm so passionate about helping other people heal, because it's such a painful area for so many people. But also, I want everyone else to be free of that burden of the mental and emotional energy that we waste on shaming ourselves.
And controlling.
Oh, my gosh. We spend so much energy on it. And if we're free of that, we have time and energy to do amazing things.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my experience. I'd love to hear from you. I love talking with you about this subject.
I love talking with you about everything.
We talk to each other a lot.
Yeah, my experience, you know, it echoes a lot of yours. I mean, and I think this is kind of a rite of passage of many people in recovery, particularly women, you know, although that's not to say that food disordered eating doesn't affect men, if we know that it does. Men just talk less about it.
Well, and I feel like diet culture targets women a little bit more. Men are told that they need to be strong and big, right?
Yeah.
But women are told they need to be small.
Yeah.
And so it's a different, but I agree. I hear from men too that this is something that they struggle with.
Yeah.
And more, and oftentimes more privately.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's really challenging. You know, my experience with disordered eating, I mean, for me, food came first before addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being, 6, 7 years old and using food. You know, I had, you know, a traumatic childhood in that I was uprooted from America and moved to the UK. I never really fit in. So I, you know, I didn't know how to regulate my emotions. I didn't realize that that was quite traumatic for me. I was in a stress response. So I was totally disengaged. Like I would, you know, Monday or Tuesday, it's always been mentioned by my family members, like, what happened to you on a Monday or a Tuesday? Because you never wanted to go to school. Mm. And I was just like so disconnected that I was like, oh, I just, you know, I feigned a headache or whatever. And I would eat all day.
Mm.
You know, I would find things to eat because, you know, at that point we were a single parent family. You know, my mum was working so hard. But food wasn't, you know, there was food, we were fed, but it wasn't plentiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there was an amount of restriction. And, you know, I was shown, you know, I was modeled a woman always being on a diet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I equated, you know, from a very young age, kind of worth to weight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I saw that. And also, if I chose not to eat something like corned beef hash or chili, whatever, you know, that was the meal, or that's not the meal, right? That's what you get. So, yeah, my relationship was challenging. And then as I grew a little bit older into my teenage years, you know, I would starve myself all day at school.
Mm.
I would save my bus money for cigarettes. I would walk to school. And I wouldn't eat all day until I got home at, like, 3:30, 4 o'clock.
Mm.
And then I would binge.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started taking speed, so, you know, the starvation continued all weekend. And I lost a load of weight, and around that point, there was the connection between, oh, like, I can use my body as a weapon with men.
Yeah.
And I got more attention, so I wanted to do it even more.
That's a really great point. So a lot of times with, you know, the way that diet culture is, when we lose weight, we are praised.
Yeah. And oh, aren't you attractive? You look great.
Yeah, you look great. And we are, we receive benefits, right? Mm-hmm. So there's thin privilege that happens.
Yeah.
And so it's really hard sometimes to differentiate, like, did I actually feel well or did I just enjoy the attention?
Mm-hmm.
And how damaging that attention can be in that focus on that being thin is good or better, right? And we're going to go into a whole episode about kind of body comparison and why focusing on bodies is so harmful.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a really interesting thing. Like if you think about what you were doing to obtain that level of thinness,
starving
yourself and doing speed.
Yeah.
And yet people were congratulating you and you were getting attention. You were being rewarded for that.
You lost your puppy fat.
Yeah.
Words that I'd heard.
Yeah. And so you were rewarded and given attention for starving yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really important to consider that when we, you know, really kind of worship thinness in our culture, that people oftentimes aren't healthy, right?
Yeah.
That they're actually harming themselves to get to that level. And we're equating that with being a good thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so sorry to interrupt. But.
No, I think it's a really, really good point. And then when I stopped taking speed, you know, obviously I put on weight, then I started binging. And then that belief was reinforced by people calling me fat.
Mm-hmm.
So, and even my then boyfriend, you know.
It's the worst.
Put on weight, you're not as attractive. And, oh, you mean I'm not as attractive as when I took speed every day and didn't eat?
Yeah. Oh, you prefer me like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at that time, my self-esteem was so low that, you know, that I punished myself. And that cycle continued well into recovery.
Mm.
You know, I didn't find recovery until I was 32.
Mm.
So, you know, it's taken the last 7 years to unpick all of the stuff. And, you know, I mentioned in the last episode, the principles of intuitive eating, episode 16, that, you know, I began working with a health coach when I was around 2 years in recovery because I felt like I was in the heaviest body I'd ever been in. I didn't feel comfortable with myself. I was lethargic. I was exhausted. I was depressed. Mm-hmm. All the things. And, you know, at that point, I just knew that there had to be more to this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd eaten a reasonable diet. I knew about nutrition. I decided to go through a nutrition coaching course, which was really informative, you know, to break it down to the cellular structure of how nutrition works and how it can benefit the body. So, and I relate this to many aspects of recovery. I feel like I feel like there's a continuum of learning that happens in recovery. Mm. You know, you learn how to get sober. You learn how to maintain. I should back up a little bit. Sobriety is not necessarily that the goal of everybody in recovery. So you find whatever recovery goal you have, mm-hmm. you're working towards that. Mm-hmm. Then you learn to live,
mm-hmm.
right? How does a life in recovery integrate with my life? Do I need to make some changes? Like, how do I need to make new friendships? How mm-hmm. do I have fun? All of those things, right? Mm-hmm. And then there comes the health improvements, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I just was going to say, we love to have fun.
Yeah, we do love to have fun. But actually, I think that's something that people in recovery resist.
Yeah.
I'm sure we're going to have an episode on this.
It's scary.
It is really scary. And we associate, we make this psychological connection between fun and using.
Mm. Yeah. So we don't want to chance.
Mm-hmm. No. So bad.
Fun
very
is
very serious.
Fun's bad. we don't have fun.
Yeah. And actually, then we make this other connection with, you know, exercise or achieving goals as fun. That's not necessarily fun. That's purpose and that's mm-hmm. meaning and that's
it's fulfilling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's not fun. Mm. So yeah, we should totally have an episode on fun.
Oh yeah.
So you know, within that continuum, then we start to approach health, right? And we make dietary changes and maybe we stop smoking. We stop some of the harmful behaviors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we look at our relationship with food. So that all happened with me, and I learned intellectually mm-hmm. how to relate my diet with what I wanted my body to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't, you know, and I lost a lot of weight, mm-hmm. and I felt great about that. But it was still very much cerebral. So it was all in my head, mm-hmm. right? There was no integration with my body. It was like I use food and I use movement as a means of controlling the health outcome that I want.
Mm-hmm.
I have no connection to what my body wants and needs.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I met you and you said, you know, I give myself permission to eat, my mind was blown. So you do what? You know, because I was still restrictive at that stage. And, you know, the past 2 years, as much as my mind has opened up to intuitive eating and learning to connect to my body, you know, that's something Portland has given me, has introduced me to my body.
Mm.
And that has been really difficult because what it's uncovered, I published an article about this week, is, you know, that early recovery and addiction masked a lot of conditions that, you know, that were going on in my body. I have autoimmune conditions. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of dissociation from the trauma that I've suffered with. Mm-hmm. I have complex PTSD. I didn't know all of these things.
Yeah.
You know, often when we are criticizing the cravings that we have, whether it's sugar, whether it's cigarettes, whether it's coffee, drugs, whatever, our body's telling us something.
Yeah.
What does it need?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a need underneath all of that.
Yeah.
And I love that this is the perfect segue into the barriers.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a person in recovery, you've experienced a lot of the barriers, yeah. right? So the barriers to intuitive eating, you know, first are external, right? So we're yeah. rejecting diet culture and, you know, we're, you know, fat stigma, all that stuff is a piece of it, right? And all of the shoulds.
What do you mean by fat stigma?
So we have fat stigma in our world, which means that if you're a person in a larger body, there is stigma that happens. There's people.
This happened to me the other night. Mm. I was threatened outside my building because I asked a guy to stop skateboarding at 10 o'clock. Against the building,
mm-hmm.
and he said, "You stupid fat bitch."
That's terrible.
Like,
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I mean, what was really interesting is my response to it. I actually laughed.
Oh, nice! I love it. You're like, whatever, dude.
Because fat's an insult, but it is used as an insult.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, clearly I'd activated some child in him.
Yeah.
And you know, even though he was being threatening and harassing, it was like, it's not an insult to me anymore. Yes, actually, I'm not comfortable in how my body is right now, but my health and determining how to function within some of the barriers that I have with my health is way more important
yeah.
than having complete satisfaction with how I want my body to look, right? Because I realize that the way that it looks is not as important as how happy I am as a person, right?
That's beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, so it's true. So this really does happen. And so we don't ever want to minimize, you know, and each person gets to decide for themselves, like, where they want to be in terms of body acceptance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're not asking people to just empirically say, like, I love the way my body looks. You know, that's not a piece of intuitive eating. I feel like people can often get there.
I was going to ask you that. Will we ever get
there? That being said, you know, there is the principle of body respect, right? So that's kind of where that's the entry point is, like, you know, how can we respect our body, which is what you're talking about, like caring for yourself and recognizing that your wellness is more comprehensive than, you know, it's not about, first of all, what size you are, what your weight is, but it is inclusive of your mental health, your physical well-being, your spiritual well-being. Mm-hmm. And you have a lot going on right now, right? So, like, we can decide how much. It's not a moral issue anymore. We can just decide how much time and energy, what our bandwidth is for focusing on health. And if we're not in a place where we want to focus on it, fine, right? And that our size doesn't equal health. So we can focus on, you know, like you've said, we can focus on having fun. That's part of our health and well-being. You know, so I love that about intuitive eating. But when I'm talking about fat stigma, I'm really talking about the actual lived experience of people in larger bodies and how, you know, when you go see a healthcare provider, there's stigma attached to it. Oh, or, you know, you potentially are exposed to people saying harmful things. Or
I remember when I first went to see a doctor in America, it's bizarre to me, healthcare in England. You know, Americans criticize healthcare so much, but, you know, and it is a very privileged thing to be able to access. Mm-hmm. I totally accept that. But it is not a bed of roses in the UK. Mm. Believe me. Like, you know, you could wait months, years before seeing a specialist. Mm. Access to care is really limited there too. Mm-hmm. Yes, we don't have to check our bank balances before we go and see a doctor, and that is a huge privilege. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we don't have that level of, you know, checking before we go in to see a doctor. We have 7 minutes, you know, and really, you know, evidence shows that a doctor literally listens within the first minute to what you have to say and then switches off.
Yeah.
Because he's already made a determination. And that's no different here. I remember when I first went to see a doctor here and I was surprised that they weigh you. And, you know, I actually told them that I no longer wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Which is really empowering.
Yeah, you can refuse to be weighed, folks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless, I mean, if you have heart failure or you're going to be given medication that's weight dependent. So if you're going to have surgery, something like that, then they do need to know your weight. Otherwise, like if you're going for a checkup or if you're going for, you know, you have a cough or if you're a woman, you're getting, you know, like a reproductive check. Yeah. Why do they need to know your weight? They don't.
No, they don't. Yeah. It's just a tool of, you know, that they use to measure health. Which, you know, BMI is no, I mean, wait, we should have a whole episode of that, is no real determinant of health, necessarily. So when I first went to see a doctor and they, you know, they were attributing some of the symptoms I had, which were depression, with my weight.
Yeah.
The reality was I just moved my entire life from the UK to America and that uncovered some of my much more deeper stuff, but they put it down to weight.
Yeah, of course they did. And the thing is that, which is, it's terrible, right? And the thing is that I have been the thinnest I've ever been in my life. I was extremely depressed because I was doing amphetamines every day and I was drinking a lot and I was smoking 2 packs of cigarettes and I basically lived on Mountain Dew. So, you know, like, I've been way more depressed at smaller weights, you know, and it's not to say I haven't been depressed at bigger sizes too. You know, but it's not a weight. People at all sizes have depression.
And I think that's a barrier too, isn't it? That some people in recovery think that, you know, that their expectation is of getting back to the body that they had when they used to not eat and take drugs all day.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. So we try to control our appetite and try to restrict and get
and then
smaller.
Punish ourselves, like you're a sugar addict.
Yeah. Oh, and I bet that there's people who go back to use because they have a hard time tolerating themselves in a larger body.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a pause here so that we can hear from our awesome sponsors.
The Alana Club of Portland is proud to sponsor the Breaking Free podcast. Your recovery, your way, is at the heart of our approach to recovery support services. As the largest and most diversely programmed non-clinical recovery support center in the United States, we've been proudly breaking barriers and forging new pathways for years to ensure everyone has a home in recovery. From peer mentoring to recovery CrossFit, from trauma-informed yoga to mindfulness training, the Alana Club of Portland has a recovery pathway that's right for you.
Here at Unity Recovery, we believe recovery should be the expectation, not the exception. Whether you find support with mutual aid, harm reduction, medication, or yoga, your recovery is beautiful and worth celebrating. Learn more and become part of the recovery movement at unityrecovery.org.
And we're back. So yeah, that's definitely a barrier. And I feel like for people in recovery, especially that, you know, we have a disproportionate number of barriers because there's a reason that we used in the first place or struggled in the first place. Yeah. And so what happens is that then we take away a coping, you know, tool. And of course, we're going to naturally gravitate toward using food. And the problem is that it's not the food. It's, you know, like you've said, it's why the pain. So why do I have the pain that caused me to want to use in the first place, or the pain that caused me, you know, this whatever suffering? Like if you're, you know, in recovery from codependency or a mental health issue, or you know, like PTSD, something like that. What is the underlying thing causing that pain? And if we don't address that pain, we're going to need something.
Yeah.
So of course we're going to self-soothe with food.
Yeah, and I think that's my problem with 12 steps is, you know, it doesn't deal with the underlying pain to some extent, you know, because trauma, you know, maybe in 1939 there wasn't as much trauma.
It's hard to say. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, I just feel like the complexity of substance use disorder is far greater these days because we use drugs, because, you know, and Gabor Maté talks about this all the time, and that's his quote, you know, not why the addiction, why the pain, right? And he says that as we age, we have a more stressful life, and we are not teaching people the ability to cope with that level of stress because it's too much. Mm. So that's why we're in the crisis that we're in, is because people are way overcommitted and they don't have the coping skills. Mm-hmm. And then children are growing up in that environment where they're not necessarily emotionally nourished. You know, you've got single parent families, all of these things, you know, abandonment, divorce, all of the things that happen.
Yeah, so we encourage people to check out the ACE test, which is the Adverse Childhood Experience. So if you check that, we can put it in the show notes. If you check that out, you can see kind of where you're at in terms of trauma you experienced as a child and how it might adversely affect your health today.
And
yeah, we'll put those in there too. So now we're going to segue a little bit more into the barriers. And so I'm just going to kind of bullet point. So some of the barriers are, you know, of course, diet culture, you know, growing up in a rigid household, right, where food, or having kind of poor modeling around food.
Yeah.
Definitely having a mother who dieted, you know, maybe you had a father who dieted, but I think most people I talk to, it's mom was dieting. Oftentimes moms put their kids on diets. And then if you're told as a child that, you know, you need to change something about your body or the way that you eat isn't right, that definitely is a barrier to body attunement and intuitive eating. You know, even if you're just told like you have to clean your plate, all of those things. So any kind of manipulation or control of your food as a child, and then any shaming messages you receive. And then I would say, you know, definitely, especially for people in recovery, as I was mentioned, so childhood trauma, any sort of, you know, mental health condition, so depression, anxiety, PTSD, for sure. Let's see, what else am I? I feel like I'm missing a few.
Other barriers. I feel like what's interesting is sometimes we pick up other people's stuff. So, you know, we get sober and you know, we find recovery and we're involved. If we go to mutual aid groups, you know, like AA or whatever, we and we are in a relationship with some kind of sponsor, then we put them on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. And I always want to say pedestal from that episode. Anyway, so we kind of idolize what they have to say to us. So if they have a disordered relationship with food, mm-hmm. that's really challenging, you know, because we adopt that.
Yeah.
Living sober actually tells people to eat sugar.
Yeah.
Like to eat candy.
Yeah.
I've had grand sponsors that told me in the early days to carry around bags of candy because my body needed it.
Mm.
You know, and we don't have the skills yet to question.
Yeah
because we're taught we can't trust our thinking.
Yeah, so definitely, who, you know, mentorship or people that you look up to, the culture that you're kind of raised in, the environment you're in, you know, if you're someone from the South versus the West Coast, like all of those cultural conditions are going to play into and have a big effect. And so that's one thing, you know, it's important to look at that and examine that. And I would say, you know, mainly for me, it's the barriers boil down to kind of wiring that we have or pain and trauma, right? So physical pain or emotional pain. You know, I was just at my chiropractor this week, and she was talking, I have a low back issue, and it's kind of energetically about support. And she was saying, you know, she wanted to adjust my spine through my abdomen, which is hard. I go through this on a weekly basis. It's actually amazing, but it's hard.
It doesn't sound
good. Oh, man, it's intense. It's the most intense adjustment. Anyway, but she was saying, you abandon your abdomen when I do this. And it was a really interesting, like, here I am, somebody, like, I teach people intuitive eating, and body attunement is a high priority for me. I do things daily to increase my body attunement. And yet, I have this area that I have pain, and I just completely, like, when she goes to do the adjustment, I try to just distract myself. And she's like, you're abandoning this whole area. And she's like, can you just try to be present there instead? And it was blew my mind, right? Like, oh my gosh. So we don't even realize a lot of times that we're doing it, right?
Well, that's where women store trauma.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. So there's definitely some stored trauma there. Definitely. Mm-hmm. I've been even doing energy work, but I'm still like jumping ship. So
the same thing this week. I had some energy healing, and when they were touching my stomach, I was making jokes.
Mm.
I was talking about things that weren't necessarily related.
Disassociation.
It was really difficult to be present.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have these, we come into recovery with, you know, all of these things. Or, you know, we go through life, even if you're not someone in recovery, like we go through life with, you know, all of this pain and trauma, and it does get stored in the body. And also, you know, it may be current, right? So it doesn't feel safe to connect with our body. And even if it's not like a hostile environment or scary, we may just not have ever developed that skill. So when you think about when you're an infant, right, babies cry when they're hungry. They refuse food when they're full. They're very, you know, intuitive eaters, right? But
they're conditioned.
Yeah, from a very young age for some people, right? So some people, even as an infant, they're put on feeding schedules, you know, or they're tried to, you know, they're forced to eat more calories, or they're only given a limited amount of calories, right? Depending. So each person kind of comes into intuitive eating with their own stuff and their own challenges. And so I think the biggest thing about intuitive eating is, as we get down, like you were saying, as we get down to what's going on with my body, we may find really challenging things to deal with. And so we have to have a lot of self-love, right? Or a lot of like grace. Yeah. 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 And so I think it's really important to create, mentally create, like, and emotionally create a safe space. And that's where you're saying, you know, coming in with curiosity, but also just recognizing, like, you might feel a little beat up, you know, this might feel scary and hard. You may end up realizing, like, oh, I need to deal with my trauma before I can even approach becoming more in tune to my body, because it's not safe for me.
Yeah.
Or you may have a physical pain condition that makes it really difficult to be connected to your body. And so getting to a place where you're able to sit in your body with that pain, it can take a lot of bandwidth and a lot of patience, but also, you know,
practice.
What's that?
A lot of practice.
A lot of practice. Oh my gosh.
Like years in recovery.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would say those are the main barriers. And, you know, you may even discover some more that I haven't said here today, but recognizing that likely if you're a person in recovery, there's a reason that you had, you used to the point of it being harmful in your body, or you drank to a point of it being harmful in your body, right? Or if you're in recovery from other things, there's a reason that those things became so prevalent and challenging in your life. So, you know, recognizing that, and instead of being harsh with ourselves, being kind.
I love that. Yeah. Yeah, because I think sometimes we're set up to, you know, even though finding recovery is a profound act of self-love and care, we're not always set up to continue that or to believe that in some ways. You know, we're taught that we need to do a fearless moral inventory of all the things we've done wrong.
Mm.
We need to look at what's wrong with us. We need to look at how we've harmed other people. Mm. And we're not necessarily set up to think, you know, well, how have I harmed myself? And what are the ways I can be more compassionate towards myself? Because if you can't be compassionate towards yourself, how can you be compassionate and kind and caring to other people?
Yeah.
Like, we're neglecting a huge part of ourselves. And actually, by focusing on other people, it takes us away from ourselves again, right? And that's what we're trying not to do in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really important. So...
yeah, I love that you said that. When I worked the steps and when I... you know, I still have a few people that I sponsor. I always encourage them to put themselves on their ninth step list and make amends to themselves. And so, and what that looks like for everybody is different. But yeah, food was definitely up there. Like my relationship with food was up there on my list for sure, because it was a way I felt like I was harming myself. And what I didn't realize is that I was shaming myself, and that was the real harm.
Yeah.
So I agree. Looking at, you know, is your recovery program or pathway or patchwork, is it something that also includes your, you know, mental, emotional, physical, spiritual wellness? And how can we make that a priority and have it be something that is a focus of our recovery?
Yeah. And if it isn't, why isn't it?
Yeah. Examining that. Questioning. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You have the permission to question a recovery that works for you.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think...
same way you have the permission to eat.
Eat what you want. Yeah. Eat what your body wants and needs, right? Like intuitive eating is something that, again, it's each person gets to decide for themselves what to eat and how to do it and what feels good to them and, you know, what principles they want to focus on and how much time and energy they want to spend. For some people, they don't want to spend time and energy worrying about food or their, you know, wellness. And that's okay. Each person gets to decide.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh. Well, I feel like we had so much to say today. I do want to just do a quick, you know, reminder of getting started, how to get started. So we went into this in our last episode, but really,
episode,
you know,
16.
Yeah, episode 16. Great. And so really it's about rejecting all of the shoulds and the judgment and the shame. And what we want to do is really celebrate any awareness that we have of that. So anytime we have a
maybe
judgmental thought,
get a bell,
yes, yay! I have awareness. Like every time you have a shaming thought and you're aware of it,
celebrate it.
That is success, because when you have that awareness, and we want it to be a positive thing for our body, like, oh, that's right, I remembered, and then we can start to change those thoughts. So we can start to go, is that really true? Am I bad if I ate some Cheetos? Oh, I'm not a bad person, even if I eat Cheetos. You know, or Cheetos are just food. I'm just trying to eat food.
Food is emotionally neutral.
Yeah. So, you know, giving ourselves that that grace and celebrating awareness. Again, questioning, right? So, and getting really curious. Like, where is this coming from? Where is this thought coming from? And then we want to really start to honor our bodies, respect our bodies by having gratitude for our body, by focusing on self-care. And getting more in touch with our body and more in tune with our body. So really, you know, actually checking in. Like, how do I feel? And actually, what do I need? And when you ask yourself, how do I feel? Like, do I feel hungry? Do I feel sad? Do I feel tired? So often I'm just tired. And I'm, like, reaching for, you know, some sugar or some caffeine. And if I can check in, yesterday, actually, before I went out, I had to like just lay on the couch for a moment and just listen to some music. And I was like, man, I'm really feeling tired. And actually just laying there for a little bit and giving my body that little bit of a break, I was able to like get up and kind of move about my day and feel okay about it versus like just pushing through.
Yeah.
You know? So in that moment, I was like, how do I feel? Oh, I feel really tired. And so it's like, okay, I'm going to rest for a moment. That's what I need. Mm-hmm. And it was great. You know, I can't always do that, but I do that more and more and more often. Mm-hmm. The more often we honor a need that we have, the more we build trust with our body.
Mm. Which is kind of at odds with certain types of recovery because we're told that we can't trust ourselves.
Yeah.
Our thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely part of why I left 12 step because I do believe that I can trust myself. And there was definitely a point in when I was first new in recovery and I was sober, I didn't feel like I could trust myself. I had to build those skills, you know, and same with intuitive eating.
Yeah.
I didn't always believe that my body would just show me what to eat, you know. I did believe that there was a reason that I had cravings.
Yeah.
But now I can trust that my body really will guide me to what I, you know, it's like, you know, walking through the grocery store and you smell the strawberries and you're like something lights up in your brain. Well, your brain's like, oh, there's what I need. You know, that's what I need. Right. And again, you know, maybe you're craving like for me, sometimes the coconut milk ice cream. Well, it's got a lot of fat in it.
Yeah.
And it has, you know, sugar. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a perfect like if I had enough calories that day, it's like the perfect solution.
Yeah.
Right. And it's coconut milk. So it's really like the fat is my body wants that fat, right? So, you know,
that's not bad.
No, that's not bad. So anyway, building that attunement and connection with our body so that we can really start to honor our needs so that we can build trust with our body. And then I would say, you know, focusing on next, starting to focus more on, you know, feeding ourselves well. And making sure that we're getting, you know, the nutrients that we need, making sure we're getting enough rest. Yeah, sleep is so important when it comes to our health and well-being and eating intuitively. Because if you're exhausted all the time, guess what you're going to want to eat? Your body is going to encourage you. Yeah. Those cookies or whatever, like chips, cookies.
Potatoes and cake.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if we can make a potato cake. I mean, potato cakes are actually a thing in England.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Like lockers?
Yeah, we just call them potato cakes.
Yeah, potato cakes. They're yummy.
I'm going to eat some potato cakes.
We're hungry, folks.
I'm tired.
It's time to take a break. Yeah. We're going to honor our needs. I'm going to use the restroom. Liv's going to eat some food, and we're going to take a little break.
Yeah.
But the point is that, you know, then we start to focus, after we start to focus more on kind of taking care of the mental, emotional piece, then we start to really focus on, you know, caring for our physical bodies.
Mm.
So.
Which we neglect so much, you know, and this is my big thing about, you know, trying to restrict sugar for people in recovery. You know, I feel like, I mean, physiologically, you know, there's no feeling about it. Like the evidence shows us that physiologically our brain chemistry is all out of whack when we find recovery.
Mm-hmm.
For years afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, there's a really great article that I will link to called What Cookies and Meth Have in Common. and he's able to, the psychiatrist that wrote it, Dr. Richard Friedman, he was able to show that, you know, people that suffer with substance use disorders have low dopamine in the brain, like low D2 receptors. And actually, you know, he goes through all the genetics. It's a really fascinating article.
Yeah.
But that's the reason why people return to use, is because we know there is a defined pathway in the brain that says this is a solution to you feeling depressed, right? And we get the same response with cookies.
Yeah.
You know, or any other like high reward food.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, the solution isn't to just take away the cookies.
No.
The solution is to develop other ways. Cookies are delicious. The solution is to find other ways to feel good, right? And to take care of our mental health.
Right.
So, yeah, so we're going to actually have a whole episode on sugar addiction, whether it's a thing or not.
Is it real?
Is it real? So we're going to talk about that.
I want to hear what you have to say.
I can't wait. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening and sticking with us. I know this has been a long one, but this is a really big topic, and it's something that clearly I feel passionately about. You know, it's the work that I do pretty exclusively.
And Tiffany, as Tracy Murphy would tell me, some people like long episodes.
Some people do. We like to keep it short and sweet.
We do. I remember when they told me they made recommendations specifically because I like shorter episodes.
Oh, yeah.
So one thing I want to mention before we close is, Tiffany, how can people find out more about your course?
Oh, yeah. So my you can go to my website, CoachTiffanyRN.com. I have a blog there, and there's also a page. Oh, actually, I don't. My course page might be hidden. So it's CoachTiffanyRN.com/course, and it's a 11-week course on intuitive eating. It includes all the principles of intuitive eating and some goal setting. So check it out.
I can share from personal experience. I've done the course and it's really powerful. You know, I had some real breakthrough moments during that course.
Awesome.
It's worth its weight. You were worth your weight in gold.
Thank you, dear.
My pleasure. Okay. So we look forward to speaking to you next week when we're going to talk about sugar addiction.
All right. Take care. Your Recovery Your Way.
We want to hear from you.
Email us at hello@breakingfreerecovery.com or join our Facebook group, Breaking Free Community.
Tell us what Breaking